Today, Sam is joined by Max O'Neill, owner of Down Under Dog Trainer, to discuss building confidence and resilience in current therapy dogs, as well as in young dogs with a possible future therapy career. If you want to get in touch with Max, you can head to his website, www.downunderdogtrainer.com, for more info. Enjoy.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Therapy Dogs Australia podcast. We are missing Max today. Unfortunately, she's not very well. But we have another Max to fill in. So I'd already organized to have two Maxes, but it just turned out that way. So we have Max, the Down Under dog trainer, with us today. We're going to have a pretty cool chat about setting your dogs up for success, building their resilience, building their confidence. Max, do you want to introduce yourself?
Cool. Thanks for having me, Sam. Hi, everybody. My name is Max. I own and run Down Under Dog Trainer based on the Gold Coast. I'm a balanced NDTF trainer running out of Australia. And I guess my long-term mission is to improve the quality of just dog owners in general throughout my time in the industry.
Hell yeah. Sick.
Hell yeah.
Max is one of our temperament assessors and has been for ages. And we get a lot of dogs doing their temperament assessments with Max. Max is on the Gold Coast, Queensland. So I thought, what a great person to have a chat to, because I think we're quite passionate about building up, as are like most dog trainers, building up the dogs to be the best version of themselves. And that's super important for therapy dogs, because we're not only having them exposed to the everyday stresses of pet dog life, which, you know, these things exist, that taking your dogs out into the community or even just stuff around the house. We're taking these dogs into workplaces and schools and hospitals and nursing homes and things like that. So one of the things that can hinder that is dogs that are weak nerved. So those dogs, it's not the right call to then take them out into these busy places where there's a lot going on, where they can get a startle, get a fright. And if they can't, it's okay for dogs to startle, but if they can't settle down, so the recovery time's what we're really interested in. So when we do a temperament assessment, we're looking at how does the dog recover, because it's not really realistic. We're not looking for bomb-proof dogs, so that we don't expect that. But we are looking for strong nerves and a quick recovery time when we do startle. The reason for that is because the type of scenarios that we're putting the dogs in and the places that we're taking them, there's likely to be something at some point that upsets the dog, startles the dog, whatever, the dog's not sure about it. But it can be really disruptive for the situation if the dog can't settle. And it can be obviously stressful for the dog, and we don't want that. So we want to prepare the dogs well from puppy, which we have some students that come to us with puppies, and we're, you know, they're doing our juniors programs and they're developing their dogs along the way. And then we get people that bring their adult dogs to us, and of all ages, we sometimes identify these weak nerve dogs. And it's something that in an adult dog, it's a lot more tricky to counteract. So we're going to talk to Max today about some ideas for, let's start with puppies, Max. How do we know when we've got a robust puppy and a weak nerve puppy, do you reckon?
I feel like it goes back to even before they're born, is the old saying of, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Is it seems to be even more prevalent in animals from what I, in my opinion. And I think even before a puppy's born, you have a pretty good idea of how that dog is going to turn out in a bunch of ways.
Yeah.
And their tolerance to stress, their confidence levels and their ability to recover is definitely one of those things that you see passed down. And you chat to any dog trainer, and if you want to know how seriously to take this, is look at how dog trainers buy their dogs. We don't just go to the first person we see, or we don't not do our research. Is some of us will see 4 or 5 different breeders and meet these dogs and spend time and test them, because we know that if mum and dad are behaving in that certain manner, well, you can bet you that pup is going to do the same. So I think you get a pretty good idea beforehand what their range is going to be. And then certainly as a puppy, from as little as 3 weeks, you can already start testing and seeing little things and behavior patterns. And nine times out of 10, these things carry forward into adulthood too, and the behaviors they exhibit at 3 to 8 weeks while they're still with their mama, in my opinion, very predictive of future behavior patterns.
Well, it's the whole nature versus nurture debate, which the answer is usually it's both. So if you've got anxious parents, then there might be a genetic component that gets passed on to the puppy or human.
Agreed.
And then even if that's not the case, then the nurture component's there. So if the pups are, they so much of what they are doing is modeling, like that's how they learn. So if they can see that the adult dog, so whether it's their parent dog or the other dogs that the breeders have got, if they're all anxious, like we all know that. We all know that if, like, we tell people, you know how people have got like their one dog and it's just like a loose unit and it's got all these issues and reactivity and stuff, and they're like, oh, I'm just gonna get like another dog. And we're like, well,
That'll fix it.
your second dog's most likely gonna end up like your first dog because modeling is just so important for them.
Oh, it's huge. And I think it's not, I'm really glad you brought that up, but I don't think it's something spoken about enough in the dog trainer industry, even by other dog trainers. I think everyone's so hell-bent on, dogs learn through association and stuff. But and rote learning. But it's also, vicarious modeling is huge. Incredible what our puppies pick up. And even, I mean, I like to give some clients some like kind of funny examples, with some reels of, let's say, where there's this one where this dog watches his owner limp down the stairs and then assumes there's something wrong with him. So he starts
Oh my God, I've
limping.
seen that.
That one, yeah. Or or there's this one where people will get like a fake dog toy and stick the fake dog toy near like a big plate of food on the table and then whack the toy in
I've
front
seen
of the dog.
that
And saying the dog will go,
too.
whoa. To ignore it is, it's huge. And you're right. If your pup grows up around anxious, nervy, weak nerve parents, then it's I dare say it's going to behave the same. The way I like to explain it with, going back to the nature nurture, the way I like to explain it with clients is your dog's genetics will dictate their range, what their maximum confidence level is, and what their lowest point will be. And then your raising will dictate where they sit in that scale. So, for example, let's just talk your average run-of-the-mill Labrador or Golden Retriever. I like to explain that, if it's a good, healthy, well-bred retriever, that dog's never going to be jumping out of helicopters like a Malamar, most likely. So its confidence level will get to like its maximum if you do everything right, will be an 8. And its lowest point, it comes from good stock. Its lowest it should ever get to is a 3 or a 4. And then you decide where you sit on that scale. Versus if you get like a really well-bred, KNPV Malamar or something, well, that dog, if you do everything right, you will get out of 10 out of 10. If you don't take that dog out, that dog might be reactive, but it will always have reasonable nerves and recovery and confidence levels, and will only ever get her as low as a 5. But then you get some dogs, like just before we got on air, we were chatting about that dog you were telling me about, is some dogs can come really set up for failure, whereas their highest point, if you get that dog and you do everything right, you do the most textbook upbringing possible to build that dog's confidence, it might be capped out at a 4 or 5. It might only ever get as high as that because its genetics just go, we are putting this ceiling on that will never be broken. You've done everything you can to get to here, but here's your max. And that's doing everything right. You see those dogs quite often. They don't end up in good homes. They end up in without having a crack, your average, uneducated, not knowing much about dog homes. And that's why those dogs sit around in 1 or 2. They're scared of their own shadow. And we're seeing, I feel like we're seeing a tipping scale where we're seeing more and more and more and more of that because, dodgy backyard breeders.
And I think how can I tell this story without disclosing people's identities? So I know someone who has a dog on a guardian contract, and I met the dog for the first time, and it was like rattled. So I was down at Redcliffe. So I was out of that, and it was rattled, man. And it was like shaking. And I was like, oh, like, is she normally like that? And the dog owner was like, oh, she's always been a bit sensitive, but she'd just gotten back from a litter. So she'd gone and had her second litter. And when she got back, they kept her to, pups were 8 weeks. When she came back, she was still full of milk, so like literally leaking milk. And anyway, this is over a couple of conversations that I got all this information. Because the dog's been back for a couple of weeks, but it's like it's just wrecked nerve. And I was like, that just doesn't, it just, it's surely it's, this is not a coincidence. I'm not a breeder, I don't know. Surely this is not a coincidence. So I messaged one of our actual course graduates who is a breeder. And I was like, so could this be like a hormonal thing? Because the owner went back to the breeder and was like, oh, she's just a bit funny. And the breeder said, oh, all you can really do to fix that is exposure. So, but I said, when the person told me that, the owner, I was like, actually don't think, I actually wouldn't expose this dog right now because I think there's something biologically going on and you won't fight that with exposure, like you'll need to address that differently. And anyway, I messaged this breeder and I was like, is it, because I was just making that up when I sent it to the owner. I was like, I just reckon. And then I checked the breeder. She was like, no, fully could be absolutely hormonal because she's not been weaned. Puppies weren't weaned. She was just removed. So whatever's happened in the breeder's life, for whatever reason, they've not weaned the puppies correctly. Because this breeder that I spoke to was like, it's, they should be no milk, like no milk by the time that guardian dog goes home. So if you think about all the hormones of being a mum with your puppies still on you all the time, and then all of a sudden you just go like that, there's all those hormones going on, but also that separation then without it being gradual, like just a snap separation. Now the dog has this nerve problem, and the my friend breeder said to me, I'll take it really slow, like get her in a really consistent routine at home, give her lots of love, and just take it really slowly. So I passed that on to the owner because I was like, it was kind of the same as what I said, but it like a little bit more detailed, you know? But I was like, oh, this is one of the things where if you're dealing with, there's a difference between like developing confidence in a stable dog to trying to build confidence. You actually have to treat anxiety in an unstable dog. So if you start with an unstable dog, so whether it's genetically because of the breeding or there's some hormone problem going on or whatever it is that's going on, there's something biological going on as well, that this is like a full-on treatment thing now because the dog's unstable. Whereas like you're saying, so those parameters that you're talking about of like, okay, 1 to 10, so your average dog should, you'll be somewhere within this parameter here of, you know, 3 to 6 if the dog's of stable breeding and, you know, biologically stable. But if the dog's not biologically stable, you're just pushing shit uphill because you're fighting a losing battle and you should still fight that battle. Like you'll be able to get to the top of, I really like the way you explain that. You'll be able to get to the top end of that scale of those parameters with a lot of hard work and dedication. But yeah, I think it's hard for owners to accept when they get that ceiling and, you know, and we're like, okay, well that if that's everything you're doing everything right. We've given the dog time and all that sort of stuff. That might just be all that we get out of this dog. And in our context, it might just be that this dog's just not going to be a therapy dog. That's just, they're just not built for it, you know?
And it's a tough conversation that's got to be had, but I'm glad that you do, because I think it's a really underrated job role for dogs. I do think it's more stressful. I do think it's more taxing, and I do think it requires more training and skill and ability than people, maybe in like the sport world, they maybe give it credit for. And you just can't have a weak nerve dog do it, and especially with the risk factor there is just huge. You know, I mean, being around population, but quite often with therapy dogs, being around vulnerable populations in various manners is, if that dog, is prone to getting overwhelmed and is prone to getting distressed and feeling very heightened and fearful, and if that dog does choose to have more of a, outwardly aggressive responses, that could be go really badly. So, yeah, no, 100% agree with you. You got to have a stable dog for a therapy setting, and some dogs are sun cut out for it. Some dogs, their ceiling just dictates that you'll never get above this level, and that's not a high enough level to be a therapy dog.
As an example, I haven't told this story in the podcast yet. This is a freshie, guys. I had a scenario. I've had millions of scenarios that I could recall gradually, but this one was fairly recent. So I had a scenario where I had an adult client, and they'd had their session, and then so this was the first time that my dog had met them. And they had a few diagnoses. So there was an intellectual disability, autism, and then some other stuff just sprinkled on top there. You really could just, throw a rock and hit a diagnosis. This poor person's just been, labeled with everything. But anyway, but what we would say for, those in the industry, it's just like a, a significantly impaired functioning individual. So I had my little Labrador Nala with me, and we'd made it, got through the session, all good. She likes the dog and that. And we'd come out to the waiting area, and the carers were there to pick her up. And throughout this conversation that took place in the waiting room, the client had a bit of a meltdown. And Nala was sitting, she was sitting on, I've got these like bench seats in the waiting room. She was sitting on the bench seat, and Nala was sitting underneath her. That's one of her favorite spots, is underneath the bench seat. Nala's sitting underneath her, and the client started screaming and hitting herself in the head. So, in response to, I don't know, something that Kara said. So Nala got up, and I was standing sort of in front of her. We've got like this setup where I've got like a reception desk, and then there's a wall, and there's this kind of this little walkway where we walk in behind the desk. And I happened to be standing in there, which was kind of opposite the client. So Nala got up, and I just sort of grabbed her by the collar and dragged her behind me, and just had her sort of like, behind my legs. And the client was saw me do it, and started saying, "I'm not going to hurt the dog." And I was like, I was already saying something else when she said that. So I was finishing my sentence. I was trying to, obviously calm them down from whatever they had heard before. And so I kept saying my sentence, and then she yelled it at me again, "I'm not going to hurt the dog." And I said, "Okay, thank you for telling me that." And I let the dog go, and you could tell like that it was just such a moment for this client. So the dog was actually trying to get back. I was having to hold the dog back. So I let the dog go, and she went and sat on the client's feet. And then the conversation became, "I would never hurt your dog. I would never hurt this dog. I love dogs." And I was saying, "Thank you for saying that. Like that's good for you to say, because, we don't want that," and blah blah. But it became like this really repairing conversation where, I was saying to her, "Well, I trust you. Like, that's why, and so she's going, so she and so she's saying, "The dog knows I'm not going to hurt her. That's why she's not running away. She's not running away from me, because she knows I'm not going to hurt her. I would never hurt a dog." It was just so important to her that I like understood and believed her. And then so I said back to her, I believe you and I trust you, and that's why I let the dog go. And you're right, she is sitting with you. So she's not scared of you.
Wow.
It's all
That's
fine.
pretty
Like,
cool.
it's all good. So repairing, right? Whereas if my dog had a weak nerve, A, that's gonna worry me. Because now we've got a situation unfolding, and it's like, oh God, like
When
my
it
dog's gonna
truly means
get,
that you've got to calm down.
yeah, exactly. The dog's gonna get traumatized.
My
Like,
therapy dog needs a therapy dog.
yeah, just get like eight dogs.
But you're right. Like it, I think that story speaks to the efficacy of therapy dogs. I think people take them really seriously now, but I think anyway, I think X amount of years ago, I do think some people went a bit like about it, maybe rolled their eyes, but I think that really speaks to like, hey, if I didn't have her there, that situation would not have diffused anywhere near as cleanly. And second, your other point being like, if we, like, we're glad we had Nala there, and we're glad that Nala is as stable and as strong nerved as she was, because again, that's a pretty challenging situation for a dog to be in. You know, dealing with a human that's, you know, again, wasn't there, but, you know, sounds like, you know, really screaming and throwing, you know, parts of their body around. Like, that's as much stress that's put on a dog on a PSA or an IGP field. They're dealing with that same level of stress, but they just have to respond to it differently. So, no, I think that's a pretty incredible story.
Yeah, when it happened, I was like, oh, it's a really sort of textbook, like what I've been trying to explain to people. This is, and I haven't for a few years, like I don't take on a lot of new clients because I'm busy. But I've taken on a few new clients recently, not because I'm not busy, but just because I'm sucker for punishment.
That's enough.
Anyway. So, those interactions, they're more likely to happen earlier on in a dog's relationship with a client. Like the once you sort of get further down the relationship, those things can still happen, but they're less likely. But also remember, this is the first time Nala had ever met this person. So
Wow.
it's not like I had a meltdown and she came over to me, you know, as her primary attachment. Like it was someone she doesn't know who was literally screaming and s literally
Wow.
sitting on top of her, you know, but she's sitting underneath the chair. And she got up, but I just didn't give her an opportunity to make a decision. Then I just grabbed her by the collar and moved her, which is one of the things that the ATL tried to ban was collar grabbing.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people are trying to ban is like any pressure on the dog. But I'm telling you right now, when someone's sitting there screaming and already hitting themselves, I'm grabbing the dog and I'm removing
Yeah.
the dog. And I don't,
One.
I just won't hear, I just will not hear that it's not okay. Because what isn't okay in that situation is for the dog to add to the stress of the situation for the client. So, whatever. So, your dog. A dog might bark at that sort of situation. We don't want them to, but a dog could bark at that situation. What do you think is going to happen then? What do
Yeah,
you
just
think's?
petrol on the fire.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or the dog, like it's the dog's a target in those situations because the client themselves is a target. You don't know what's going to go down there. So yeah, the dog got dragged, like
Yeah.
absolutely, she got dragged and just put behind my legs. And I just kept my hand on her collar and she was lean, so she wasn't like really pulling, but she was leaning into the collar, which is the only reason that I let her go back when the person was like, I'm not going to hurt your dog, still yelling. Nala was leaning into her and was still only like half a meter away at that point, you know, like I was only half a meter to a meter away, probably a meter away would be a more reasonable, I'd say. But yeah, leaning in to go back. So that's, yeah, let her go. Blah, blah, blah. That's
Wow.
what happened. So when we say like we want strong dogs,
That's why.
that's why. So yeah, it's hard to I think when we can illustrate with examples like that, I think it helps people to gather their understanding about it. But I don't want to scare people away as well if you're thinking like, oh my God, my dog, like I don't know what my dog would do in that situation, or I don't know what I like. That's not the first time that sort of thing has happened to me. I've been doing this for a long time. So I've had many situations where I've been like, okay, so now we're just going to handle the client and we're going to stay calm. And I'm just going to remove this dog by using collar pressure. I'm just going to remove the dog from the situation until I can assess what's going on for the client and I can assess what's going on for the dog and I can find the best way to repair this. And I'm going to stay calm the entire time. And I'm not worried about what the dog, I'm worried about the dog, but I'm not worried about the dog becoming traumatized from this. That's not on my radar. So, you know, I'm going to protect the dog's welfare and well-being, of course, but I don't have it in the back of my mind of like, oh my God, like my poor dog, my dog, my dog, my dog. I'm not freaking out like that because I know that these are strong dogs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And oh, yeah, I don't think either of us can state enough how important it is to have a dog that fits that mold, that has that strong resilience for that role. But I think we should chat about how do we build the dog up? So we talked about your dog coming with her own little genetic ceiling. When we tell people about how do you make sure you get your dog as high as they can be? How do you get your dog to be as strong a recoverer as possible? How do you get your dog to be as confident and outgoing and just having a healthy relationship with their comfort zone?
Absolutely. I'm doing this with Kiki at the moment, my Anatolian shepherd. She's not even 5 months old. It's ridiculous. She's like massive. She's huge. It's crazy.
I'm gonna come up and meet this dog.
You'd love her. My vet horse vets were out today and I was like, did you see my dog? Because she's in her pen. Like they drove past. And they're like, oh no. I'm like, I'll go get her out when you're getting ready to leave. I'll go wake her up. And they're frothing. Like she's probably gonna be the shittest guard dog, like for people, because she like loves people and she's really sweet. And yeah, she's
I
big
do.
lean, got that lean, big dog lean. And how they lean on you. Oh,
I'm
it's
in the
so
same boat. I
cute.
mean, Nelson does all his PSA and stuff, and he knows like when he's at club to do it, but when he's at home, he's just a s like he's never asking a rep, but he is just like, hey, coming in, like I'll show you where the safe is. Can I lean against your leg? Like, can I see my belly? Like, terrible. I hope that changes with age, but we'll see. We
Well,
will
that's what I
see.
was thinking too. I was like, oh, is this dog like would kind of be good if you could guard the house from like burglars in the middle of the night? Like, if we could add that to like the dingo problem, if we could just add like randos running through Caboolture, that'd be like a
Be
bonus. At the
fantastic.
moment, she's just like, everybody, hi. We have a, so I'm gonna, I use a lot of like human sort of stuff to understand the dogs without going full like anthropomorphic. If anyone listening knows the circle of security parenting model, that's what I'm talking about. For anyone who doesn't know it, basically, one of the things that I'm looking for when I'm raising a puppy is to be a really strong base for them and but let them go and explore. When you let them go and explore, so that's the opposite of helicopter parenting. Let them go and explore, but whilst they're exploring, checking in. So we're checking in with them, we're watching, we're available. So with human kids, if you think about like you take them to the playground, but you let them go and play, but you're watching them. And they'll check in with you, like they'll look back and be like, hey, like, watch me do this. And you're supposed to be like, that's sick. Like, that's amazing. And they're like,
Do a
watch
flip.
this. And they like do like the lamest jump ever. And you're like, that's great. So we're checking in with them. And then when they feel like they need to return, that they come back and we're available there as that strong base and we're there to organize their feelings. We're wise, we're kind, we're strong, we're all those things. So if anyone's Instagram algorithms are doing the same thing as mine, it's a lot of dog trainers walking reactive dogs and just going full noise on dogs off lead, running at them. So it's like something's happened to my algorithms at the moment. That's all I'm getting. So
Just getting flooded with it, yeah.
I'm like, I know this story. But they're doing the real, like, I think they get a bit emotional about it. But anyway, they're doing the real, like, so body blocking. So, like, another dog that's running towards your dog, they're blocking their dog's body from that other dog. And instead of like picking up your dog and, having a nervous breakdown, they're like yelling at this other dog, like, fuck you, dog, get away from my dog. Ah! And they're like screaming at the people, like, get your dog on lead. Ah!
But you're so right. The dog absolutely picks up on that. Hey, they're like, I don't know quite what happened, but my human said blah, 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 blah. And magically, we've got space. It's so
Yeah.
important for our dogs to see that.
I reckon it is. I reckon I believe in that. So I believe that when my dogs have seen me like stand up for them and like they've seen me, address another dog or whatever, which it doesn't happen very often, but same with Brumbies too. Like they're the same. Like if they see me do something first, they're like, whoa, so
Interesting.
brave. She's so brave. Like,
Fearless leader.
gonna listen to her.
And I think that's why advocating for your dog is a bit of a buzz phrase at the moment, but it's true. I do so firmly believe that our dogs are intelligent enough to analyze that situation, be like, hey, that was about to go pear-shaped. And then mum went fucking mental. All of a sudden, boom, that dog's is, off in the other direction. But I like what you said, your original point of, I forget the name, but did you say circle of trust parenting?
Circle of security.
That's exactly what it should be for your dog. And that's the way we explain it to people. In the same way that you see a child fall over and look back at their parents and kind of go, hey, how are you responding? I'm going to respond the same way. Our dogs are the same. And if you go out into the world and have this very anxious, demeanor about you and worry, your dogs are picking up on that. And I guess that falls into one of the things that we really educate our clients on the topic of resilience. On the topic of resilience building is eustress. It's not putting our dogs in constantly stressful situations, but it's also not avoiding it entirely. It's finding that sweet spot in the middle where the more we expose them to that eustress or that healthy, positive level of stress, the more resilient they're going to be to it. Because I think it's one of Glenn Cook's favorite sayings on the canine paradigm is the difference between the poison and the cure just comes down to the dosage. And you can absolutely just go, you can absolutely break a dog by constantly throwing them in the deep end until their confidence is just shot. But equally, you can also just knock their confidence down to zero by completely avoiding the world, especially at that critical age of, 8 to 16 weeks when you first get your dog. Is if you don't get your dog out, and when we talk about resilience building, it is getting your dog out, putting them outside of their comfort zone, and developing a healthy relationship with that comfort zone. It's why we do things like the fucking leap of faith at year 10 school camp. It's how many people can put their hand up and go, yeah, I jump off buildings for a living. Like, fucking none of us. But it's all down to I did that and it pumped up my tires so big and developed my relationship with that comfort zone. And although I don't jump off fucking buildings for a living, that positive relationship with my comfort zone helped me push for this promotion in this field or encourage me to have this conversation or start this venture. And I guess that's a human sense. But it's the same for our dogs. Is a part of our puppy school, we do our Pro Pups Academy, we have a different theme for every week. So last week we had noises week, where we have, thunderstorm and fireworks simulation. We have a groomer come out and get our pups used to the blower, the trimmer, the water and all that. And next week we've got surfaces week, where our dogs get used to going in ball pits and walking over tin foil and over ramps. And we explain to people, go, look, if your dog was a guide dog or assistance dog or therapy dog, some dog with public access, then walking over these different surfaces is specifically important to them. If your dog, it doesn't fucking matter at all. But what we're trying to do is develop a confidence building exercise and a healthy relationship with that confidence, with that comfort zone. Sorry, is it tonight your dog is going to encounter, say, 10 different surfaces and textures, and that's 10 times that they're stepping outside of their comfort zone. They encounter a little bit of eustress, but things work out well for them. And they start to learn, hey, when things go a bit scary, it's I don't need to crumble. I just need to maintain composure and step into it. And things work out okay for me. And that's the biggest difference between getting a confident dog and not, I think, is just a healthy relationship with a comfort zone and not stressing them out completely, but not hiding away from it. You just got to just keep chipping away and giving them those new experiences. And you do that, and that's really where you get them to their individual ceiling, I think.
So when I was in grade 12, I went on the Sooks camp. They had the proper camp where
Was it the
everyone
sixth
went.
camp?
Yeah. I went on the one where like there was two groups. There was the group of kids that were doing like the backpacking and hiking, camping thing. And then there was the group of Sooks who did the cabin thing. I went on the Sooks camp and I broke my arm jumping off of a merry-go-round. And the teachers wouldn't let me go to the hospital. They taped a stick to it for 3 days.
Oh, what? You got like a little like gum tree flint
They
on your arm?
literally got two sticks and taped
Flint?
them to my arm and put it in like an arm triangle sling thing. And no joke, that was on, like, we arrived at the camp and we found a park and I jumped off this merry-go-round and jumped, like, snapped my wrist. And it was like, we all heard it snap. It blew up massive, this massive big lump. And yeah, they made me stay at camp for 3 days. Broken arm. I went to the
Damn.
doctor as soon as I got back and they're like, yeah, it's broken. And I was like, oh, cool.
That's brutal. That's brutal. How
So what does
does that affect your confidence,
it mean?
Sam?
What are your parameters if you like go on the Sooks camp and then you break your arm and then so good. So I was going to say on that as well, when we are like talking about advocating for the dog, one of the things that I want our like young dog students to know, so all everyone that's training their puppies and adolescents, when the one of the reasons that we say please just don't socialize these dogs at your workplace is because it is really hard to advocate for your dogs. Okay, so let's think about the situation that I just spoke about with the client, with Nala. That's not the time for me to advocate for my dog. So if I had a puppy there and something like that happened, now's not the time for me to go, I'm just going to have to advocate for my dog here. I'm acting in professional capacity. I'm this person's psychologist. Like I actually have to advocate for the client, the person. So one of the reasons that I don't want people taking the dogs into the workplace is because I know what can happen, and I know that it's really hard to advocate for your dog in those times, and also that you really shouldn't be a lot of the time advocating for your dog in that scenario. You actually have a job to do. So then when you're having to balance out the needs of the dog and the human, when the dog is still in such a fragile time of their life, and you can't always prioritize what the dog needs straight away, you're really setting yourself and your dog up for failure in the long run. So you might take your dog to a workplace, it might be fine. Nothing, it might be already very strong, whatever. It might be fine. But let me tell you now, these parameters, this scale that Max is talking about, if you're one of those people who's like, your dog is naturally or genetically or biological or whatever, if they're more likely to be down that lower end of the scale, and then something happens, that some kind of single event trauma thing happens to the dog, you can set yourself way, way back, and you may actually break the dog's nerve because it can take one scenario and the dogs can have a single learning event from that kind of thing, and then you've broken their nerve, and it takes so much time and effort and work to counter condition the dog back to being around, you know, that type of person or in that type of environment or in that sort of thing like that. So I like what you're saying about your puppy programs, because that's the right time to invite the dog to play with their confidence, and building confidence and resilience should be through play, just like it is with children, human children. So as opposed to dog children, which are called puppies. So obviously it wasn't that. Damn it. So if you think about play in this in a similar way to what we do with humans, then you can think about, okay, so it's better to build resilience through play when they're little than to wait until they're teenagers and life starts to kick them in the balls. And we're like, oh, why do you have all these mental health diagnoses now? Like, you know, what happened? Is it, you know, what's going on here? Well, sometimes some of that can be that we haven't had enough opportunities to maybe not win an award for showing up when we were a kid, or we haven't had enough opportunities, you know, when I was a kid, if other kids, you know, if you weren't nice to other kids, they were allowed to not play with you. Whereas now, you know, you can do whatever you want to other kids and they get told they just need to play with you anyway, and things like that. So if we don't get to go through those kinds of challenges when we're younger and throughout play, then it's going to make stuff harder down the track. But setting up opportunities for your young dog, so, you know, different surfaces and different games and activities, but doing it in a fun way, doing it through play is like the best way to go, because you're not then stressed about what is going on. Like it's just a game. So it's like, it's, yeah, you can go at the dog's pace.
Exactly. Our puppies aren't even aware of what's happening, and you said it there. It's just going at your dog's pace, just letting it happen organically. And it's when you do stuff like that and you make it like that, it's not that hard, but it's just so important. One of the other things we get our dogs to do, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, is I've actually probably got a hard copy behind me here, is we give every dog one of these. It's our little plug, but not really a plug, ProPups Academy socialization checklist.
Is
And
this on your,
what we
can people
do,
buy this on your website? Because I feel like I saw that
yeah, you can. So I'm trying not to plug it, but we give it to all our puppy clients, is We give it like it's got a bit of a spiel about why you need to do it, how you need to do it, but then we just give people a list. When people talk about socializing their dog is, I think a lot of people think socializing a puppy is just getting them used to other dogs. And I was like, well, that's very one-dimensional and that's just classic overexposure. But socialization is everything. And that is, as they're going back to resilience building, is this is it, is if our dogs become worldly, if our dogs have met tall people, short people, black people, white people, big dogs, little dogs. They've been in busy environments, quiet environments. They're truly comfortable ever, and that's how they build resilience. Because just in that early life stage, if you're taking them out everywhere, they're meeting. We've got here large and loud people, babies, children, people with canes, people wearing unusual headwear. That's our people page. And then we've got different sorts of environments and just all different things. And the feedback we get, people go, "Well, I never thought to do that level of detailed socialization, but now that I've done that with my second dog and I compare them to my first dog and how I did it, they're worlds apart." It's just building that confidence is, I think a lack of confidence is honestly the stem of, don't want to put a metric on it, that most behavior problem. If your dog's not confident, they're gonna hate being left alone, separation anxiety. If your dog's not confident around dogs, then boom, you've got some sort of reactivity most likely. If your dog's not confident in your environment, you get a dog that shuts down and is defiant and disobedient. You got a lot of these problems stem from a lack of confidence, both in the pet world, but especially as a therapy dog, is if you don't have that, it's kind of almost no point of trying other stuff. If your dog can't be confident, you got nothing.
I think it's like a welfare thing too. Like if there's anything, like what a we're talking about confidence and resilience, but really like a clinical lack of confidence and resilience is anxiety, really. So like once it gets right down that end of the scale, we don't want our dogs living with anxiety. It sucks. Like it's,
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
it's
And doing like more frontline behavior stuff is one of the things that truly astounds me. When I meet people, they'll come to me with an 8-year-old dog and they go, I've got my notes out. How long has this been going on for? They go, 7 years. And they're like, you've let your dog live in fear for 7 years. And to me, it's so unfair and it's so sad. It's like your dog is being petrified and living in like terror of the vacuum cleaner, something they see 5 times a week. It's like, imagine if we lived in a house with something that we thought could kill us, and we expose that thing, overexpose that thing 5 times a week. Dad.
it is sad, and I feel like that at that point they come along when it's like really bad and often beyond like. So, separation anxiety is like one that I'm like really like it's just seems it just get like when it gets to the point when the dog's hurting themselves, like they're destroying things and they're trying and they're hurting themselves. It's so awful. It's really bad. I haven't seen a lot of that like as a dog trainer. I haven't dealt really with that. But I've seen it before in people's dogs and it's like very
Oh,
distressing.
I've seen dogs who have just ripped every pad off the bottom of their paw, bit their
Yeah.
nails down to the nerve. I've seen dogs who have chewed through drywall and got this so sick from eating
Yeah.
drywall and insulation. You see everything, and that's where that resilience building has to be broad, but it also has to be quite specific. And I think it's your responsibility as a dog owner to prepare and condition your dog for what their life may look like in future.
Yeah.
If you're the sort of person who goes, I'm going to work from home, you're never going to be alone, then maybe getting them prepared for separation isn't as important. But if you're going to be away from your dog for 8 hours a day in the not too distant future, don't just mollycoddle them for 4 weeks and then rip the band-aid off abruptly. You've got to set them up for success. And if you plan on taking your dog to a building site, it's like, well, you've got to then prepare your dog for that. I do think you have to be quite specific somewhat, which types of eustress stress you expose them to, because it has to be specific. And otherwise, if you have those holes in it comes back to bite you. And how do you do that in a therapy setting when you have dogs that come to you from 8 weeks and they go, hey, I've got this puppy just to be a therapy dog? What sort of situations are you asking them to put those dogs in so that you know those dogs are going to be right for it down the track?
The same as every other dog from 8 to 16 weeks, like the same thing. But one note that I tell them is if your dog's out and about and it wants to meet new people, let it. Just if the people are happy, you know how when you take a puppy out and people want to, you know, they want to pat the puppy and stuff. And then They encourage the puppy to jump up and to mouth and all that sort of stuff, and you get stressed because you're like, oh, I'm trying to teach him not to do that. Like, I'm trying to teach him not to jump up. I'm trying to teach him not to mouth and all that sort of stuff. I remember that from my first dog when I was just used to be so stressed about it. But in that early time, mouthing easy to fix, jumping up easy to fix. So I prefer to not put the owner's anxiety on the interaction of the dog meeting a stranger. I prefer to let the dog just get so reinforced from the stranger, like then they get up and they're licking a puppy breath and all that sort of stuff. Prefer the dog to just be like, this is it. Like, this is what it's all about, is like meeting new people, and this is sick. And you'll find people that want to pat a puppy, they're dog people. Like, they know they're going to get mouthed. They know they're getting jumped on. They know they're getting licked. Like, they're, putting their face in dog's face. This is if the dog's like into it. So obviously, like a dog that's initiating that sort of stuff, I'm really enjoying it. But on the flip side of that, so if your dog is nervous to meet new people, then I'm going to be really careful. And like you said before about like overexposure, or what some people might understand as flooding, or we could also talk about like incorrect socialization, where it's not just about shoving a lot of things in the dog's face and the dog in a lot of environments. It's about doing it correctly and doing it at the dog's pace. So I'm going to use that circle of security model when, I want my dog to meet new people and have new experiences, but I don't want to like throw them out of the car and be like, enjoy life, like, yeah, like just everything's, you do, like I want to the puppy to know that I'm your base, like I'm, and so if you're with me, you're safe. So some dogs might take a little bit, puppies, they might take a bit longer to develop that. Some of them take a little bit longer to settle after they come home with you from the breeder. Every dog's an individual, so it's really for me about going at this dog's pace and letting them get that reinforcement if that's what they are like. They're like ready for it, they're ready to meet these new people, and they're like, yeah. But if they're not ready, then also not forcing that too, because then I think that's how we can cause some fearfulness when the dog feels like, I don't know this person, like I'm actually a bit overwhelmed in this situation. And I think it's important to then abort mission, get out of there, and slow it down.
And that goes back to, like you said, it's your pup learning to trust you. If your pup sees you as not that circle of security, goes, hey, every time I'm with you, really shitty stuff happens, is you don't want to become that common denominator for your dog, or you don't want to classically condition your dog to be fearful of you because sucky stuff happens every time you're around.
I can't remember if I've talked about this before, but when Nala was a baby, so how I was saying before, like your dogs learn from each other, so you're a shit dog, you're gonna have another shit dog. So I've got the best dog in the whole world is my 12 and a half year old Labrador, Sunny. Been a therapy dog for 11 years. Best dog in the world. And he has helped raise my other dogs. So, which is absolutely, you can capitalize on the modeling thing big time.
We could do a whole podcast thing. I am so passionate about.
So he has helped raise my other dogs, and so my other dogs are also stable. So and then they can help raise the next dog, and then they've also helped my client dogs, like they've helped other, like board and train dogs and that sort of stuff to become stable because they're stable dogs. So anyway, I was like, I got Nala. She's nearly five. She's four and a half. And I don't know, I just didn't think it through or didn't expect or whatever. But I had paired her up with the boys, thinking I always took her out with one of her brothers, so Sonny or Oliver, and because they were modeling, like they're so brave and stable and confident dogs. And then she got to about like, she must have been like maybe 6 months old, or I can't remember. Still young, but like old, like maybe she was even seven. Like, so I got her in December 2019. Does that add up? Right before COVID, right? So she got to go to a puppy school, but then everything got locked down. She didn't get to go anywhere after puppy school. So I take this dog on her own for a walk down Redcliffe Esplanade for the first time, thinking I've got this really confident young Labrador because I'd taken her out with her brothers. Lord help me, this thing was having a meltdown. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? What I had done is I had made the boys her base. I hadn't made myself her base. So she walking down the street, she wasn't looking to me for like, oh, we're safe. And whereas she was looking for her brothers and they weren't there. And she fell apart. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like I was freaking out. I'm like, I've wrecked this dog. Like I've wrecked this dog. Like, oh my God. Stressing. Luckily for me, she had enough good going for her that we were able to get right back up that
Yeah,
scale. You
nice.
know, like she's a really, like she's a great dog. You would never think anything like that, you know? But yeah, it really opened my eyes to like, oh, I have to be her, what makes her safe. Like it's not, I can use the boys to help me with some stuff and social, you know, I can use them for some stuff, but I relied on them way too much. But yeah, that's how important it is that your dog sees you and is blatant,
Oh,
blatant.
1000%. And that, and dipping back into that modeling side of things for a second, is that's where that codependency can really start. Because if you bring your puppy back and they go, hey, there's a dog and there's a human, you're naturally going to just, go towards your own species. Also, when they're going out, as much as we think, look at my little puppy trotting along looking at me like that, it's like, no, they're actually trotting along looking at the other dog like that. Is one day when you go, hey, we're doing this solo, they go, where have they gone? Yeah, totally agree with that. And I think it is something people underestimate because, everyone starts off with one dog at some point and then adds others. Is that first dog you get is they're doing everything on their own. So, of course, they're generally a bit confident they don't need no other dog. But at some point, when you get that second dog, is you got to understand that, hey, these dogs' experiences are going to be very different. Things like building your engagement is going to be tougher. Preventing codependency, and that's such a good point you brought up, Sam, is how you shape their socialization experience so that you become their circle of security is huge. Because if your other dog's in the frame 9 times out of 10, that's who their circle of security is. It's not you.
That's it. Yeah, I saw it firsthand, guys. I made the mistake. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I did it too. So, you know,
Yeah, I'm
no
done.
judgment from me, but it's good that to talk about it because it is something that you, or if you just got a second dog or whatever, it's something that you need to be prepared for, and you are going to have to separate them and spend that one-on-one time with both dogs so that they get everything that they need and they understand that you're there. It's like their primary attachment, which means like you're their main attachment. Like it's not, you don't want your other dog. They can be bonded with the other dog. That's great. It's beautiful. But you need for them to know that you're their primary person. You're their primary bond. Yeah. So other things like for building confidence, I'll touch on. So Kiki, the LGD, I built her this flippin' pen thing out on the beside the goat's paddock, and I was like, it needs to be finished before she gets here because she's gonna live in this pen. Like she's an LGD, she's got to be with the goats all the time. Anyway, brought her home. The story of bringing her, she got stuck at the airport, blah blah blah. Anyway, all went not to plan. So bring her home, and I'm like, oh okay, just put her in the pen. Nope. She was howling, and I was like, okay. So the conventional dog training model is to don't just leave her in there and let her cry it out. One of the things that I think is important to acknowledge, though, so she's a livestock guardian dog. So she needs to be very strong nerved, and she needs to develop discernment. She needs to be just a really confident dog. Bonded with the goats, but she has to bond with me as her shepherd as well. So when you have such a large breed of dog, and potentially dangerous dog, I think it's very important that we mold her over time rather than chuck her out in the yard and then be like, oh, well, she's very anxious out there.
Yeah.
Just deal with it. Because the things that she was going to be exposed to at that point was possibly foxes, certainly wallabies, certainly rabbits, and potentially dingoes as well. So the dingoes don't come through all the time, but they are around. So what if I leave her out there? She's already scared because she's just, you know, she's just gone, been, you know, brought home from a breeder. She's flown from New Zealand to Australia, got stuck at the airport all day, brought her home, chuck her out there. I think that that was an opportunity to cause a traumatic experience for her, which if she gets a fright out there at that age, that's, she was 9 weeks old, that's something that could potentially traumatize her for a long time. So we're like, okay, we're going to have to adjust our plan. We brought her over to the house and put her in a, like a yard that's like right on the house. And it's like, right, like my bedroom. I've got a glass door that you just like right there, you know? So she's been in there. She got, you know, we built her up and she got really comfortable being in that space, but it was always going to be the case that she needed to go out into that pen because it's on the goat yard. Like it's, she needs to be with the goats to really develop that bond. So you, even though we got comfortable, you know, we met the need and she's not ready to be out there by herself. I don't want to get a fright out there, traumatize her and all that sort of stuff. So just like I'm saying to you guys, like if you just take your therapy dog to a workplace and they get a traumatic event happen in the workplace, then what if they are, you know, they develop an aversion to the workplace or they develop an aversion to the type of client that you're working with? That's what I was worried about having her out there so early. She's, what if she gets a fright and she's scared of wallabies? Like, that's not going to work for us, like at all.
So
she was in this yard that's sort of like on a patio of the house. But over the last, so then we had to start spending, okay, much shorter periods of her in the pen. I'll be in there with her in the pen. Lots of other time bonding her with the goats. Gradually, you know, have her in the pen, me outside the pen, where she could see me, where she briefly couldn't see me, things like that. And she would howl, you know, and to be like, okay, but you're okay because it's daytime and, you know, I'm just right here and that sort of stuff. And then starting like last week, she's actually been able, so she's 4.5 months old. She's been able to be in that pen now. Fine. Totally fine. Whether I'm home, not home, doesn't howl, doesn't carry on. She like pulls to get, like when I take her out there, she like pulls to get into her pen. And then, you know, she goes to this, she's got her favorite little spot under the tree. I've put, made sure I built it around a tree. She's got her favorite little spot under the tree where she sleeps and all that sort of stuff. So that's an example of like, okay, so, I could have just, ripped the band-aid off and just left her out there and had her howl for a few days. And I was like, the neighbors are going to be so angry, but no, I really didn't want to, but, can do it that way, and yeah, they'll eventually stop howling. But what impact does that have longer term on the dog's nerve and their relationship with you? Like, they're not howling anymore, but is that because they've developed like a learned helplessness where they're like, there's no point crying because no one's no one's gonna come and help me? And one thing that really, like, I make her drag a long line around a lot because she's a menace so to the other dogs. So she gets caught sometimes, like she'll get caught on her long line on something, and she'd do that same noise where she's making that same little noise at me, and I have to be like, oh, where is she? And she's calling out to me because she's a baby. So she's calling out to me saying, I'm stuck here. Like I've separated from the pack. I'm separated. Like I'm stuck here. And I'll go back and save her. And she's like, oh, okay, off we go. I think that's genetically in them, like to be like, hey, I'm separated, like I'm on my own, like I'm
help.
You know, survival, like help me.
Exactly.
But now she's sweet, she's so happy and comfortable in her pen now. I think it was worth it. That's how I've sort of conceptualized it around that sort of thing. So if we can think of things that way as well, around, I don't want you to coddle them. So coddling her would be she doesn't like it in the pen. That's it. Like that's it. We just don't address it again, you know?
Running away. Yeah.
I don't want you guys to do that with your dogs. I just want you to expose them to things gradually and with good experiences as much as you can, especially with a really young dog. This is your time where you can make the biggest impact. Once the dog's, you know, 12 months, 2 years old, that's it. Like, you've largely, they are who they're going to be. So everything that we have to fix from that age onwards is a lot more difficult to fix. So if we can get through this early stage in a lot more positive way, with a lot less sort of shit going on, then you're going to have an much easier time as the dog, as an adult.
Agreed. Well, it's called building confidence for a reason, because it's something you've got to do over time. It's not just something that's just done. And going back to before, you sort of spoke about, you know, do I just leave her in there? Do I do this? And I'll have clients that, you know, come together, you know, what should we do? Should we just do this? And it's the old sink or swim approach. And we had a quite literal experience with this with Nelson. When he was a puppy, he didn't take to the water like straight away. He took quite a few exposures to warm up to it. And on one hand, I could have gone, I'm just going to chuck him in the deep end and make him swim back to shore, and he'll figure out how to swim. If that had worked, I would have a dog, okay, cool, I've saved myself a bit of work and a shortcut of this, cool. But it's also, you're on a knife's edge. It could go the other way. And has that dog just learned a behavior or learned to do something, or have they actually learned confidence? No, you'd be like, all right, I can get myself out, but I don't really like the water. And same for the therapy dog setting. It's like, you can just chuck them in the deep end, and best case scenario, it works and you save yourself a little bit of work, but you might not even build the confidence. Whereas if you take it slowly and chip away at the problem and build it, well, then you're stable. I mean, Nelson loves the water now, as an example, my dog, and he has had a couple of experiences at the beach where he's being dumped and whatnot. But because we built that confidence, he's not a house of cards. He shakes it up and goes, oh, fuck, I'm almost drowned. If he was quite fragile and gone, look, I'm already 50-50 on this water, one bad experience can just tip it. And that's why you've got to build, guys, and be really gradual about things, because the more stable your base of support is, one little bad experience is going to be seen as an outlier rather than a key or a core memory in relation to that thing. And it's the same with your own dog. When I had that tricky client the other day, I'm sure your dog was like, huh. Today was a big day. That was an intense person, but that was just one of many experiences rather than something, you know, super prominent or super early on.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important also to remember that as the handler, guys, you're a part of this picture. So it's one thing to be like, yeah, okay, I chucked the dog in the pool and it can swim. It's another thing for your dog that you chucked them in the pool and they thought they were going to die. So
it's like, there goes your circle of trust.
It really, I think it's so important. And I had this conversation with someone the other day, actually, where they asked me a question. I can't remember what it was, but it was something about their dog. And I was explaining to them, like, it's just so important to me that my dogs know that they can trust me. Like, it's just so, so important to me. And I think for therapy dog work, it's vital that you as the handler, the dog knows that they can look to you, do those check-ins, and you're always going to check in with them. And, you know, you're looking back at them and, you know, making that eye contact, reassuring them, and you've got your little language that you speak and all those things. And they regulate off of that. You're organizing their feelings when you're doing that. You're helping them navigate a situation because they're looking to their leader to figure out, like, hey, man, is this something to get fired up over, or are we cool? And you're like, hey, man, we're cool. And they're like, oh, okay.
Agreed. If you ever want a way to think of it, the analogy I like to give clients is, if you're on a flight with some turbulence, you tend to look to the most experienced person you can see, which is one of the flight attendants. And if they're cool, calm, collected, you go, I'm sure they see this sort of shit a lot. If this isn't on their radar, it should be on mine. But if you see them and they're like white knuckling on their seat, like, you know, crossing over their chest and trying to call their mum, you go, oh, fuck,
we're all going to die.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you need to be that for your dog.
That's it. That's, I think I really like that. That's a great analogy. We're probably gonna steal that. So thank you very much.
Oh, dude, it's so funny. We all do. I feel like whenever I get together with other dog trainers, we just swap analogies. Like, oh, that's a really good way of putting it. And we just sit there and be like, how do you communicate this? And we all just bounce off
Yes.
little metaphors and analogies and the yeah.
It's the best. So one of the things I think people can do with their dogs to build confidence, so we've, got that socialization, get it right. If you're not sure if this is your first dog, you don't know what you're doing. If this is your fifth dog and you think you know what you're doing, but you're listening to this and you're like, huh, what do they mean by that? Talk to a dog trainer. Like, either talk to us or speak to someone that's in your area that you can do face-to-face stuff with. But get advice because it's too important to just sort of, oh, she'll be right through that, especially critical period. But the adolescent period is really tricky too. So we can get some funny behaviors popping up. We can get some sort of hormonal things popping up and stuff like that. And when you don't know how to respond to a dog, which we all have times like that, like I've never raised an LGD before. So I'm absolutely in that boat of like, I've told you guys, like I've got a dog trainer who's an LGD expert who I can just message videos and things to and just be like,
That's
okay,
awesome.
so what does this mean? Checking things with her. So like I'm doing that because I'm training a new type of dog. So if this is your first therapy dog that you guys are training, then don't feel like, I've got heaps of experience with dogs. So hundreds of dogs, not even just my own dogs, hundreds of dogs. So if I still am like, huh, I wonder what this is all about, then you guys reach out too. I like playing games with the dogs, and I really like finding that sweet spot where you let them win the game. I really like that's like my favorite confidence building thing with young dogs, where they, especially if you want to develop a dog. So like, you know how you see all the like PSA kind of bite sports stuff, and they're like got decoys, and the dog's like biting their arm, and they're like tapping them with a stick thing, and they're like getting them the dog like really excited. I play that game with Nala, so but I don't have a bite sleeve, and she's not biting me, but we play tug, and I get her real like drivey, like she's real like, argh! And I'll like pick her up and swing her around to side to a bit, and I'll like try and like you go, and then when she gives a really big effort, like she's like, I'm gonna take this, then I let her have it, and then she's like, I am the strongest girl in the
100%. And I think that's a good way to finish is look at cut like we'll always come full circle here. We mentioned right at the start that word we get stuck on anthropomorphizing. I probably butchered
not
that.
it.
But I think, yeah, not even close. But I think sometimes, it's good to not do it. Absolutely. Dogs are dogs. They're not people. But I feel like sometimes we run so far from that that it can really cloud the way we look at things. And sometimes it's as simple as to look at it like this. If we think back to school, and I like to compare dogs to kids because that's kind of their mental capacity, is the kids that are the most confident, the ones that are good at stuff, they've got things going on, they try things and things work out well for them and yada yada yada. And if you do the same with your dog, if you play the games with them and show them, hey, you're like the best dog on the planet at fetch and tug, and hey, look at you today, you went to that beach and you weren't scared that way, like well done. It's like if we could pump up those dogs times, it's no different to kids. Give them stuff they're good at, give them new experiences, and be that circle of trust. So circle of
Security.
security for them, sorry. Be that circle of security, and you do that, you're pretty well home and hosed, hey?
Yeah, and like we let little kids win games. I have to do that all the time at work. It's really painful for me where I'm like, oh,
Are
you
you
got
super
four in a
competitive?
row. Like,
Oh my God.
but equally, once I'm sort of like, but then like if a kid I'm trying to build them, then yeah, I try and let them win a game. Like try and, some kids cannot win a game at Connect Four to save their lives, but generally speaking, try and let them win a game. Whereas there are some kids that come in and they're like, I need to beat this kid at a game. Like this is what needs to happen here, as I actually need to beat this kid at a game. So you guys might be listening to this. If you've got a dog that's already a really strong, confident dog, This advice might not fully apply to you. So just be aware of that as well. Like your dogs are individuals. If you've already got I don't know if this is the right word, but if your dog's a little bit arrogant or a little bit like full of themselves and that kind of stuff, this might not be the right dog to let win a lot of tug games with you. That might be a situation where now we've created a little bit of chat and the dog's like, oh yeah, that's right. Like I'm stronger than you. So take that, and I also make all the other rules around this house. So when you can win a tug toy, come back to me. So
Yeah, I think what I was speaking to today is the people who are maybe, and if you found this podcast, it's probably because you are worried about this. So we're really speaking to the people who may have a dog that they, after listening to this, might go, yeah, I think my dog does have, thin or weak nerves, and I think I do need to build their confidence and resilience. And that's who we're speaking to. If you've already got some drive confidence monster, then you're already looking pretty good. You don't need to
And if you're
let
not
them get to you.
sure, if you're listening and you're not sure which one you've got, speak to someone. Don't just listen to this and then go, I'm just gonna change everything I'm doing in my dog's routine and every way I interact with them. If you've got more questions, then speak to someone, organize a consult or something like that, because you may need a trainer to actually have a look at your dog so that we can give you a bit of information about whether or not this one's needs some building, or if this one needs some, we want to make sure that this dog's parameters don't get to that 10 out of 10 level kind of thing. Whereas like a dog, like, so even like your PSA dogs or a dog like Kiki, my LGD, I'm trying to get her up there. Like I want her like right up there. So
Oh
that's a different situation again. So, it is complicated, guys, but yep, we're aiming today to help, build confidence in those ones that you're sort of thinking, I just don't know if this dog's, well, all puppies and young dogs, let's build their confidence.
Yeah, I think we've been quite therapy specific today.
Good.
I think, yeah, we spoke about dogs. If you're looking to build up towards being a therapy dog, or if you've got a dog you're a little bit worried, I think this, or I hope this conversation's been helpful.
Thank you so much, Max.
No, thanks for having me, Sam. It's as that worked out well for timing. Nelson is spamming his toilet button by the door. He's got that little
Hilarious.
talking button at the door, so he needs to. He's just. It's funny. It started off really nice. It was like, oh, this is quite nice. But sometimes you just be like, bang, 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 and just mash that thing. And
My dogs are never getting those buttons ever.
oh,
Ever.
yeah. Well, speaking of the buttons, I'm just about to start reading this, How Stella Learned to
Yeah.
Talk, and I understand conditioning the dogs to the buttons as in like the certain event, like open this door, open that door, food. And that's all he's got. We live in an apartment, so he needs to, and I'm not having those grassy mats inside, so he needs to tell us when he needs to go down. But looking at this dog, she's got one like happy, mad, sad.
Are
Kind
you
of like, I don't
following
know
her
what.
on Instagram?
No,
You
I
gotta
can't.
follow her on Instagram, Stella with words or whatever it is, because
Yeah.
that dog is running the show. Like
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
probably a bit
yeah.
harsh, but like I'm like, okay, so and
Yeah,
it's
the
so
dog is
sad.
very in control of
She's saying, but she's
everything.
saying sad things. I'm like, I don't have, what is going on here? Like, she's like, Stella's sad. Like, and I'm like, oh my God, like, what is happening? But
Yeah, I'm like, how do you teach that? I don't know. Look, mate, I should probably reserve judgment for after I finish the book and do a bit more research. My immediate thought is, yeah, nah. But anyway, that's speaking of talking
some
buttons.
people are right into it. And I like it is,
Yeah.
I've got, I'm following a hunger for words. Hunger for words is her
Right.
Instagram. There's a couple of others out there as well, and they've got like pretty good stuff. Like it's, if you're into it,
Okay.
it's pretty cool. Like the dogs, it
Yeah.
seems like they're saying what they think, but
Okay.
I'm just saying,
Yeah.
like the dogs at my house, they'll be not doing
No, that's fair. I think as soon as we get out of an apartment, those buttons will be in the bin.
Yeah, you have a dog door, take yourself out of the
Yeah,
toilet.
beat it. Go. Well, thanks heaps for the chat, Sam, and thanks for having me on. Really, really appreciate it. I feel like we opened up a few other tabs where we could definitely pick back up at some point,
Definitely.
with a few
Yeah.
other topics. So,
Endless, endless tabs.
cool. I'd love to have another chat. Speak soon.
Excellent. Thank you, Max. See ya.
See you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you're interested in studying with Therapy Dogs Australia or you have a few more questions before deciding, please get in touch with us by emailing courses@therapydog.com.au or visiting our website at www.therapydog.com.au for more information and FAQs.